If you have a podcast and want to monetize it, stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
Medical Frontiers is an informational program sponsored by the Allegheny Health Network. The information featured on Medical Frontiers is intended solely to further the public's general knowledge of current developments in the field of medicine and should not be relied upon as offering advice, diagnosis, or opinions as to any individual treatment or problem. Nothing should replace the relationship that you maintain with your personal physician.
Well, good evening. Dr. Gerald Piper here in another session of Medical Frontiers. And this Monday night, I guess we're going to get a little snow after midnight, Rob.
Just a little snow. Yeah. Maybe 6 inches, but I probably a dusting, I would say. That's my opinion. I'm not a meteorologist, but that's my opinion.
That's your opinion. Okay, we'll take your opinion. All right. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Crohn's disease and colitis. And we're very fortunate to have a gastroenterologist on this evening, who is a specialist in inflammatory bowel disease and other gastroenterology problems that he sees on a daily basis. And welcome to Medical Frontiers, Dr. Ashkash Desai. How are you this evening, Dr. Desai?
Hi, Dr. Piper. I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on the show again.
Oh, you bet. And when we talk about inflammatory bowel disease, just tell us a little bit about what those words mean. I understand that it's an autoimmune disease in most cases who have like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, and so on. And just give us a little background exactly what we're talking about.
Sure. So inflammatory bowel disease, also called IBD, is a chronic immune-mediated disorder. So like you said, it is an autoimmune disease that affects the GI tract, meaning your body's own immune system recognizes something as foreign within your GI tract, which leads to inappropriate inflammation. Now, like you said, there are two main types. One is ulcerative colitis, or what we call as UC for short, and the other one is Crohn's disease. Now, with UC, as the name implies, the inflammation is mainly limited to the colon, and it involves the inner lining of the colon called the mucosa. And it classically starts in the rectum and moves up in a continuous pattern. Now, you contrast that with Crohn's disease, that can basically affect any part of the GI tract, from the mouth all the way to the anus. And the inflammation tends to involve pretty much all layers of the GI tract, not just the inner lining as we see with UC. So this can lead to more complications like blockages in the bowel, what we call as strictures, or fistulas, which are these abnormal tracts or connections between your bowel and the adjacent organ or another segment of the bowel. The disease is common in the U.S. You know, over 1 million Americans, you know, have this disease, and it typically occurs between the ages of 15 to 30, although we are seeing more late-onset IBD, especially in our elderly patients.
Okay, and what about the incidence? Is it pretty steady? Do you have any idea what percentage of our population is affected with inflammatory bowel disease? And
I would say certainly the incidence of IBD in the Western Hemisphere is certainly increasing. I mean, if I had to give you a rough estimate, in North America, the incidence is somewhere between, you know, there's a huge range, but anywhere from, I would say, 7 to about 30 individuals per 100,000. So that is fairly common disease, and certainly we've been seeing an increased incidence over the last 10 years or so.
Is there any reason for that increased incidence, Doctor?
I mean, I think it's a combination of different things. I think it's mainly, I would say, a combination of the environment and our diet, and we can, you know, chat more about that later. But I think it's mainly driven by environmental and dietary factors.
And what about genetics? Does it run in families?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, this is one of the most common questions I actually get from patients is, you know, why did I get IBD? What are my risk factors for getting IBD? And genetics is actually number one on there. So having an immediate family member, like a parent or a sibling who has IBD, can increase your risk of having it. You know, we have lots of studies from European countries that have shown that the lifetime risk is about 5 to 6% for ulcerative colitis. If you have one parent with IBD, that risk can increase up to 10% if you have two parents, and even higher if you have multiple family members. And the risk is even higher for Crohn's disease, closer to 10% if you have one parent, but can certainly go up to 20-25% if you have two parents. So genetics is pretty big in terms of risk factors for IBD.
Well, let's talk about Crohn's disease first. And what are the usual symptoms that somebody might have that they go to their PCP and say, this is happening to me, and then they referred to a gastroenterologist at that time? Or just tell us about a typical patient who has Crohn's disease.
Sure. So the most common symptoms with Crohn's disease can include diarrhea, like unexplained diarrhea that's been present for a long time, blood in the stool, abdominal pain. Some patients can also have things like urgency, meaning that they need to run to the bathroom quickly, otherwise they might have an accident. Some patients also get diarrhea that wakes them up from sleep. In certain cases, you know, some patients can have nausea, vomiting, and even unexplained weight loss. So it could be like a combination of different things, and it's usually a spectrum. But the other important thing for listeners to keep in mind that in many people, Crohn's disease presents without any symptoms. So, you know, you could just have a patient who's presenting for a routine colonoscopy, you know, for colon cancer screening, where we might end up seeing some inflammation or ulcers in the colon or in the small bowel, or even incidental inflammation that is picked up on a CAT scan or an MRI for another indication. So okay. That's what I would say would be the most common symptoms. Uh-huh. I think the other important thing is that with Crohn's disease, you know, given that a fair amount of patients can present without symptoms, but in both Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, you can have something called extra-intestinal manifestations of IBD, meaning they have like no symptoms related to the GI tract, but they can have symptoms like unexplained joint pains or the skin rashes, even certain blisters or, you know, canker sores in their mouth, which can be seen with Crohn's disease.
I think one of the problems you also see is that these patients may not be getting proper nutrition because they're not absorbing the nutrients like a normal bowel would.
Yes, that's correct. So that's why, you know, we are, especially in the more pediatric population, we do see patients, you know, they might not have much symptoms, but they have very mild Crohn's disease that's, you know, affecting their absorption. So, you know, sometimes unexplained weight loss could be a presenting symptom of very early onset Crohn's disease.
Are there certain foods that seem to make the symptoms worse in somebody who has Crohn's disease?
It certainly can. I mean, you know, we know for a fact that, you know, ultra-processed foods are by itself risk factors for both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And there's more and more research now coming out that these processed foods are directly linked with inflammation in IBD. So certainly if you have a patient that already has a diagnosis, increased consumption of these type of foods can increase your risk for complications. The other big group is, you know, in a patient whose diet has a very high level of, you know, fatty foods, like fast foods, things like that, can certainly, you know, aggravate their symptoms as well. So those would be the two main sort of food groups, I would say, which can worsen your symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what's a first line of defense once a diagnosis is made? Does it take a biopsy to make a diagnosis, first of all, and then are there medications that can be used in somebody with Crohn's disease?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So, you know, often in certain situations, the diagnosis of IBD isn't straightforward. And, you know, it is basically a clinical diagnosis, meaning we need, you know, to draw information or data from, you know, a couple different tests to, you know, ultimately make a decision. So that could mean a combination of blood testing, stool testing, in the appearance of inflammation and ulcerations on your colonoscopy, and as well as the pattern of inflammation on your CAT scan or MRI. And then biopsies are important component of this as well. But as we know, you know, even with the biopsies, there's no gold standard finding that will...
You've built a great podcast. The content's solid. The audience is growing. But the money, still not where it should be. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your podcast for free so you can keep doing your thing while our experienced sales team does their thing, finding advertisers and bringing in revenue. No fees, no stress, just real monetization. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
That defines IBD. So I would say it's usually a combination of different things that, you know, helps us make a diagnosis.
Okay, we need to take a break. We're talking about Crohn's disease this evening and also colitis. And we have as our guest this evening, Dr. Desai, who is a gastroenterologist with Allegheny Health Network. We'll be back after the break. 866-391-1020. Okay, we're back on Medical Frontiers, and we're talking about Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And our guest this evening is Dr. Desai. He's a gastroenterologist with the Allegheny Health Network. And why don't we go right to the phone? Is that Nick? Okay, Nick, you're our first caller. You have a question?
Yes. My wife has been on Entyvio for a few years. Every 2 months, she gets an infusion up there in Wexford at AHN. And I'm just curious about what the typical dosage is for someone like my wife who gets this infusion like every 2 months.
Okay. Dr. Desai, his wife is getting an infusion for inflammatory bowel disease. And tell us a little bit about that.
For Crohn's.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about that, Dr. Desai.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Entyvio, or, you know, the other name for the medication is vedolizumab, is a fairly common medication that we use for management of inflammation for Crohn's disease. And so, you know, the regimen that your wife is on, Nick, is fairly common. So typically patients get this induction phase where we give them 3 infusions, which are spread out over 6 weeks, and then ultimately they transition to the maintenance dosing, which is essentially 1 infusion every 8 weeks or roughly 2 months. So, Nick, that's probably a standard dosing that your wife is on, I would say.
Okay, because it's been very, very effective in helping her to control her Crohn's. We haven't had any incidents. You know, when she first got Crohn's, she ended up with inflammation where she had have part of her intestine removed and ended up with an ileostomy.
Okay.
I see. I'm glad to hear that her inflammation is better controlled now on the Entyvio.
Yeah. So that was my curiosity about this dosage for every 8 weeks. So I just very interested in listening to the rest of your program, Doctor. Thank you very much for it.
Okay. Thank you very much for that call. We appreciate it. There are a number of medications that can be used with Crohn's disease. Are there new medications in the pipeline also, Dr. Desai, for Crohn's disease?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, in the past, I would say 3 years or so, we've seen an explosion of a variety of different medications that have been approved both for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And there are several other drugs that, you know, target different pathways of inflammation that are currently being studied or undergoing rigorous trials, which, you know, we should see approval coming soon in the next several years. So it's an evolving and exciting field. And I suspect that the landscape of medications for IBD will change in the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay. mentioned that his wife had surgery. She had a portion of her small bowel removed. Is surgery often necessary for Crohn's disease?
Yeah, so, you know, unfortunately, even with the approval of, you know, all these medications, you know, we haven't necessarily seen, especially for Crohn's, a decline, a significant decline in surgery rates over the last 10 to 15 years or so. And so roughly, you know, the numbers that I quote my patients is in over a period of 10 years since diagnosis, about, you know, 25% of patients might need, you know, surgery for Crohn's disease at some point in that 10 years. So still fairly common. So surgery still remains an important sort of component in managing the disease.
Okay, those same medications we're talking about, given by infusion and so on, are those medications effective with ulcerative colitis also?
Yes, so many of the medications, or I would say most of the medications that we have are used both for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. For some medicines, the doses might vary, but most of the medications are common between both colitis and Crohn's.
I see. Patients who have either ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, are they at a higher incidence of developing bowel cancer?
Yes, so especially if for both colitis and Crohn's, if they have inflammation that's present in more than a third of their bowel, that does increase their risk for colon cancer. So often, you know, once patients have had at least 8 years of the disease from diagnosis, we essentially enroll them in a surveillance program, given that, you know, their risk for colon cancer increases 8 years from diagnosis. So typically most patients get their surveillance colonoscopies anywhere from 1 to 5 years, depending on risk factors.
Mm-hmm. People with Crohn's, I've heard that one of the ways they are followed is to look at markers in the blood. And tell us a little bit about that. What are these markers, and how do they help with the treatment of Crohn's disease?
Right. So in terms of blood markers, so, you know, there's lots of markers that have been studied, but, you know, none yet have shown to be, you know, effective, at least in the United States, to sort of help us mark. I mean, we have certain surrogates in terms of blood testing that we sometimes use, but by itself, they are often not reliable. But we still use them because they can sometimes help us catch very early onset of inflammation. So we do have one blood-based test that we often use to monitor the patient's disease. But what I commonly use in my practice is more a stool-based test, which is basically a marker of inflammation in the colon, even in the small bowel. It's sort of like a proxy for the colonoscopy. And, you know, sometimes that can help us sort of track how patients are responding to their medication. So it's a very useful adjunct to the colonoscopy to track the patient's disease.
Okay. We need to take a break. This is Medical Frontiers. We're talking about Crohn's disease this evening, along with colitis, ulcerative colitis, with Dr. Akash Desai. He is a gastroenterologist with Allegheny Health Network. So give us a call, 866-391-1020. We already had a call about from a man whose wife had Crohn's disease. So 866-391-1020. We'll be back.
Medical Frontiers is an informational program sponsored by the Allegheny Health Network.
Okay, we're back on Medical Frontiers. We're talking about Crohn's disease and colitis this evening with Dr. Desai from the Allegheny Health Network, Division of Gastroenterology. So give us a call, 866-391-1020, if you have a family member who has Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, or if you yourself have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis and you've had treatment, or you think you might need treatment, you haven't talked to your PCP yet, or whatever. We would love to hear your story, 866-391-1020. 1020. We talked about if infusions, doctor, is that a lifelong thing for somebody with these diseases? Dr. Desai, are the infusions a lifelong thing for people with these diseases?
Yes, they generally are. I mean, you know, unfortunately, with all the progress and advances in science, we still don't have a cure for this disease. So ultimately, our treatments are designed to control the inflammation from the disease itself. So when you stop these infusions, there is a high probability that the inflammation could come back. So for most patients, I think the medications are lifelong.
Mm-hmm. Are there people that have ulcerative colitis and also Crohn's disease concomitantly at the same time?
No. I mean, these are two very different diseases, but we certainly see situations where a patient may have been diagnosed with ulcerative colitis, but, you know, may have had actually Crohn's disease the whole time, which, you know, goes back to, you know, the challenge of, you know, making a diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease. You know, sometimes when we make the diagnosis, it can sometimes be hard to differentiate whether this is, you know, colitis or Crohn's disease. So, and we don't realize that until, you know, several years out from the disease when they start developing all these complications that we see from Crohn's disease. So, you know, patients don't have both at the same time. Mm-hmm. They either have the ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease.
Okay. But it can actually be in either the small or the large intestine, either one. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Crohn's disease can affect both, either your small bowel, your mm-hmm. colon, or both together. But the ulcerative colitis only affects your colon.
I see. Okay. Nick said that his wife had a ileostomy. Is that pretty common with these diseases from a surgical standpoint?
Yeah, so I mean, the most common location for Crohn's disease is in the most distal portion of the small bowel, what we call the ileum, and that's a very common location where Crohn's disease pops up. And so, when patients develop complications like, you know, bowel blockages or fistulas, surgery is pretty common. Common way to treat that. And so some patients may opt to get an ileostomy. I'm not, you know, it could be very multiple different circumstances why Nick's wife may have had an ileostomy, but it is not uncommon by any means.
Okay, who, in your training and your practice, how young was the youngest patient who came up with a diagnosis of Crohn's disease?
So, I mean, Crohn's disease, you know, because I mainly see adult patients, so I don't see, you know, very early onset, but certainly our pediatric colleagues can see, you know, there's something called very early onset IBD, meaning that the kids get diagnosed with either Crohn's or colitis, you know, before the ages of 6 years old.
Wow.
So you can certainly have very early onset IBD that early on.
And you said it was like most common Crohn's disease between 15 and 30. What's the oldest patient that you have seen with a new diagnosis of Crohn's disease?
Yeah, so I mean, the oldest I've actually seen is a patient who was 83 years old. So it's hard to say, you know, whether this is a new diagnosis or, you know, they may have had, you know, Crohn's disease all their life, but mm-hmm. for whatever reason, they start having symptoms or the disease started, you know, flaring at the age of 83. So it's sometimes hard to say, you know, many of our patients live, you know, with this disease for many years until they start having symptoms. So sometimes, you know, we don't even know how long these patients have had this disease before we make the diagnosis. So that could certainly be a huge component of this.
When should a patient see a medical doctor when they have symptoms of diarrhea, abdominal pain, cramping, and so on, should they get concerned after a few days, a few weeks, or a few months?
I mean, generally, like the main feature of this disease is chronicity, meaning that, you know, you have these symptoms for a long time. So that's why if someone has, you know, new onset symptoms of, you know, diarrhea, you know, abdominal cramping, blood in the stool, you know, those things could be from, you know, several different things. But
make money from your podcast with the Odyssey Creator Lab. You create the show, we bring the advertisers. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com.
Certainly, if the symptoms have been present for several weeks to months, that's when we start worrying about things like Crohn's disease or colitis.
I see. What do you see out there in the future? I don't know how long you've been in practice, doctor, but how about out in the future? Do you see an increased number of medical treatments like infusions, or can there be some possibility that these inflammatory bowel diseases can be prevented?
All right. I mean, that's a great question, and that's something that I get very commonly in my clinics as well. So, you know, there's certainly a lot of interest and research, both for, you know, better treatments for our patients with IBD. And, you know, the answer may just not be in, just medical therapy, but more looking at our gut microbiome. You know, could there be something there that, you know, we might be able to leverage to, you know, better get these patients into remission? So there's a lot of active research ongoing in that space, you know, to find other treatment avenues to target, to get our patients in remission. And certainly prevention is a big aspect, you know, like I said, especially for patients who have family history or, you know, patients who, you know, have this sort of prolonged preclinical phase, meaning subtle signs, symptoms, or something in their blood work maybe that could indicate that these patients are at increased risk for Crohn's disease or colitis. There's also a lot of active research happening, and, you know, we've made some progress, but it's still not, you know, ready for commercial use. So that, I think, is the future. Is ideally we would, you know, want to identify patients who are at increased risk for Crohn's and colitis and be able to sort of modify their risk through microbiome or medication or maybe even diet to, you know, prevent the diagnosis of IBD.
Okay. Well, we need to take a break. We do have a phone call in the queue. Just hang on and we'll take your call after the break. But this is Medical Frontiers. We're talking about Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis this evening with Dr. Desai from AHN, the gastroenterology group. So give us a call, 866-391-1020. We'll be back. Okay, we're back for our last segment of Medical Frontiers, and we're talking this evening about Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis with Dr. Akash Desai from AHN. He's a gastroenterologist and specializes in inflammatory bowel diseases. 866-391-1020 is how you can talk to our expert this evening. Let's go to Susan and... Susan, do you have a question?
Hi. Good evening, doctors, and thank you for taking my call. I have a son with Crohn's disease. He's had it for maybe 15 years, has been through several different medications, did have an ileostomy, but was able to have that reversed.
Reversed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was taking Remicade and had a very severe reaction to it, and then after that he tried Humira, and he was on the Humira for a few years now, but the patent for Humira has expired, and he insurance dropped the coverage for the Humira, and he's now on a biosimilar. But my question is about these medications that target interleukin. I think those are some kind of proteins, like interleukin 6, 17, 31. Is there a way, do they ever test patients for these interleukins to see which ones maybe somebody's deficient in, and like to help target which medicine would be best?
Okay. Dr. Desai, how about that question?
Yeah, hi, Susan. Thanks so much for your question. And you ask a very great question. And, you know, certainly, I wish we had some sort of way to test, you know, what is the predominant inflammation pathway that's, you know, driving Crohn's disease in your son. And unfortunately, we don't have the sort of test available right now. And that, you know, should hopefully be in the future. But, you know, a lot of the times, you know, we try to target one aspect of the immune system. Like you said, for example, your patient, your son was on Remicade. So, you know, we were, you know, hoping that, you know, that would be the predominant pathway that's driving the inflammation for his Crohn's disease. But, you know, often it does tend to become a trial and error because, you know, like I said, we don't really have any kind of test which will tell us that, you know, hey, this is the predominant sort of inflammation protein that's driving Crohn's disease. And so we certainly have medications that target mainly interleukin-12 and interleukin-23. But, you know, depending on the severity of his Crohn's and complications, that often drives what medicine we pick for the Crohn's disease.
Does
okay.
Answer your question?
Yes. And so far, the biosimilar is, he's having success with that. So we're just going to go with that for a while.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, that's, I just wanted to like reassure the listeners as well that that's going to be fairly common moving forward in the future, that, you know, many patients will be switched from the brand name to the biosimilar. And there have been multiple studies which have been done which show that switching to the biosimilars is equally effective and safe compared to the original drug. So that should be completely fine.
Okay. And one other comment I have is after the ileostomy, he is now taking vitamin B12 injections.
Okay.
I think that's fairly common for if you have your small bowel removed.
Yes, that's correct. So, you know, vitamin B12 is commonly absorbed in the bottom portion of your small bowel. So when you've had a resection there, it can really affect your body's ability to absorb vitamin B12. So that's fairly common, Susan.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call. We really appreciate it. Jim? Okay, let's go to Jim. You're our next caller. Jim, do you have a question?
Dr. Desai, when I hear the word ulcerative colitis, I keep thinking of people that are under a lot of stress. I know the former Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, suffered from ulcerative colitis. In fact, I think that was one of the reasons he left office. Is that what causes it, or is it maybe the chemicals in our food and that, now that Health and Human Services people have been commenting about that?
How about that, Dr. Desai?
Yeah, so, I mean, certainly, you know, stress is an important component with inflammatory bowel disease. Certainly, you know, stress can, you know, aggravate your symptoms, especially your GI symptoms. And there are some studies which show that some stress can definitely increase your risk for flares of ulcerative colitis. So it's very important to sort of, you know, get that, you know, managed and controlled. But, you know, certainly, you know, we don't have much research that, you know, it is the predominant driving factor. I think with your other question in terms of chemicals in the food, like I was, you know, discussing with Dr. Pfeiffer earlier, you know, a lot of our foods are processed or ultra-processed. So, you know, those sort of, you know, chemicals like, you know, things like emulsifiers, high fructose corn syrup, you know, all these flavorings, high level of added sugar, salts, preservatives, unhealthy fats. Those are, I think, are more major drivers of gut inflammation. So that's what I would, you know, say to kind of minimize intake of those types of foods.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your question. We really appreciate it. And Dr. Desai, how about the ratio of men to women? Is it pretty equal?
Yes, it's equally common in both men and women.
Okay. And how about any ethnicity incidents of Crohn's or ulcerative disease, ulcerative colitis at all?
Yeah, so certainly we do see it, you know, more commonly in the white population, but it is rising in other groups like the blacks, Hispanic, as well as the Asian population. But historically, it's always been higher in the white population in both the U.S. and Europe.
How about as far as geography? Different parts of the United States have higher or lower incidence of Crohn's or ulcerative colitis?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. I think it's fairly similar across the country in the U.S. And I don't know much about globally everywhere else in the world, but, you know, we're certainly seeing an increased incidence, you know, in Asian and South Asian countries as well. But in the U.S., it's certainly fairly equal across the country.
I see. How about in other parts of the world? Are there some countries where you don't see it at all, and or countries where it's more popular?
I mean, generally, like more popular, like I said, in the Western Hemisphere, so like our European countries and in Northern America. But you know, certainly, you know, especially like with more of the Eastern Hemisphere adopting the more westernized diet, we have seen we are now seeing an increased incidence in those areas of the world as well. So it's certainly going to be one of those things to kind of keep a close watch on, because it is definitely a global disease now.
Okay, we're almost out of time. Why don't you say a few sentences about people who may have symptoms like we've been talking about with inflammatory bowel disease, and what they can, if they have been had a diagnosis of one of these diseases, their outlook in life?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that last point? I missed that.
What was it? Yep.
I'm sorry, I just missed the last of your question.
Okay.
Can you repeat the question for me? Sorry.
Okay. Well, we've run out of time. Thank you very much, Dr. Desai. You've been a good guest. And we'll say goodnight for our audience. And we'll be back in 1 week with another show on Medical Frontiers.
Medical Frontiers was an informational program sponsored by the Allegheny Health Network. The information featured on Medical Frontiers was intended solely to further the public's general knowledge of current developments in the field of medicine and should not be relied upon as offering advice, diagnosis, or opinions as to any individual treatment or problem. Nothing should replace the relationship that you maintain with your personal physician.
Make money from your podcast with the Odyssey Creator Lab. You create the show, we bring the advertisers. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com.